Hello, listeners. This is Kevin Kosar of AlcoholReviews.com. I am here with Bill Owens, the author of a beautiful book, The Art of Distilling Whiskey and Other Spirits. Bill is a peripatetic guy, a guy who has lived a really interesting life, and a man who has an incredible quantity of knowledge about both fermented and distilled beverages. And I feel awfully lucky that we managed to get hold of him for a few minutes to talk to him a bit about what he's up to, about the American Distilling Institute, which he founded, and this terrific book, which is just loaded with gorgeous photos and all sorts of information. Now, Bill, first question I have is, when did you get into distilling, and what got you into distilling?
Well, I started as a brewer. I founded one of the very first brew pubs in America called Buffalo Bill's Brewery, and then I did two more brew pubs, and I tried to do an IPO and get more money, and eventually I just couldn't make it happen. I maintain a business, sometimes you have luck, and after running a restaurant pub for 14 years, you burn out on that. And I had an antique store for a while, and then I made Elton John bought a bunch of my photographs. I'm a photojournalist, and I had enough money to make a trip across America. And on that trip, I'd made a list of distilleries, and I visited a distillery. When I got back, I had a list of 65 artisan distilleries, and decided to do a trade association called the American Distilling Institute, and that was 8 years ago. And so it's just an LLC, and the way to make money or to generate money in an industry like this is to have a conference. So I had my first conference 7 years ago, and we had 65 people at the first conference, and now we are breaking 300 people.
Terrific, terrific. And the American Distilling Institute, what you mentioned conferences, what are its other activities, and what are the sort of things that make it worthwhile for folks to come by and join up?
Yeah, I think the primary thing when you join is you get the directory, and in the directory list all the distilleries in America, all the big distilleries, all the rectifiers, those are people who buy and blend and import, they're all listed. But more important, if you're interested in starting a distillery, is all the equipment brokers. For example, in the world, and I'm talking the real world, there's only 5 equipment manufacturers of stills, and 3 of them are German, and only one in America, and one in Scotland. So you can look at these, you can email, you can go to their websites and begin to get some ideas on how do I put together a business.
All right. Now, moving to the book, The Art of Distilling Whiskey and Other Spirits. Like I said, it's a really beautiful book, lavishly illustrated. Who are the readers you are aiming for with this book?
I don't worry about that. That book was a accumulation of 2 trips across America. I made a second trip to really get to more and more distilleries so I could meet everybody firsthand. And when I started out, most of the books I publish, by the way, are print-on-demand books. I have 4 or 5 of those out. I have a Modern Moonshine Techniques out and a couple others that are doing quite well. They're on Amazon, but people don't realize it's a print-on-demand. But with the whiskey book we're talking about, I knew that there would be a bigger audience out there, that I could end up in the Borders bookstores and reach out to the community at large more on the consumer side. And so I had all the images. I knew who to contact to write the text. But when I looked for a publisher, I went to a publisher out of Boston, and this woman was assigned to me who was like 30 years old and was telling me how the book was going to look. And I'm all bent out of shape. Wait a minute, I've driven across the country twice. I know exactly how I want my book to look. I've done 7 or 8 books. and finally, on a Sunday afternoon, I'm taking my mandatory nap, and I said, I'm not going to do this book. And the phone rings, and it's my friend Alan Dickey from Chicago, and Alan says, what are you going to do about that book? I said, Alan, I'm going to pull the plug. I'm not going to do it. I can't deal with Rochelle. She's got her opinion how the book's going to be, and I just can't cooperate. And Alan says, let me do it. I said, okay, Alan, I'm going to give you the photographs. I'll give you the contacts of the writers. I'm going to back out of this and really let you get this team of horses behind a wagon. So Alan was the person who pulled the different chapters together. Mm-hmm. And that took us, I think, about 6-7 months to pull it together, a little over a year to get it published. But he was able to do the political balance, because what a publisher wants and what I want out of a book was different, and we're able to make the compromises, and now I have to tip my hat to Rockport Press. They did a great job on the book.
Yeah, speaking of Alan, I see that he's the author of The Buying Guide to Spirits.
Yes.
But he also manages Allied Beverage Tanks Incorporated, a company that builds craft breweries and distilleries, which that strikes me as a fascinating sort of bit of expertise to be able to bring to the table and help out with the book.
Yeah. Also, he's a regular judge at the Beverage Testing Institute in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
so he knows the wine, beer and whiskey business as well as anybody I know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to have that kind of person who's your equal, or if not better, to pull new things to the party. You can't do it all yourself anymore. Everything's a cooperative effort. And to also, the real advantage we had on this, because I'm a photojournalist, the photographs came together professionally. Look, it's not snapshots of these things. And then we, on labels, the other thing, we could scan that. And I knew to draw, when I go someplace, I always know to take an exterior shot of the building, and along with doing a close-up of the labels and the medium shot of the people or the stills or whatever. So there were a couple thousand images to pick from to put the book together. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a book right now from images left over in that book. I had all the labels scanned, and 2/3 of them didn't get used in the book, so I asked their permission to use them, and they said, no problem. So then I went out and sent letters to everybody to get more labels. So I'm going to do a book that will probably be 150 pages long, just of artisan labels. And then when I'm in Europe, I pick up every artisan label I can. They're very funky and very interesting. I have a little European section in the back of the book. Because when you look at the artwork, it kind of tells you something about the people. I'm looking for the words handcrafted. If they don't have handcrafted, I say, what's the matter with you people? You're handcrafting a product, and you don't promote it. You know, you got to let that consumer know that you're making these one at a time. You're not a big machine out there.
Mm-hmm.
So books start as one idea and they evolve into something else, and always spin off of that.
Yeah, you mentioned that Alan did a lot of the work of pulling together some of the contributions for it. You had other writers out there who submitted
this? Yes, I think we used 5 different writers, and then we did. I don't remember who did the interviews of some of the people in the book, but we did some interviews also of movers and shakers in the industry. But I knew who they were. I just didn't have the time to call them, set the interviews, get the stuff transcribed into the Word document and off to the designer. And that takes a lot of effort now,
yeah.
And was able to do that. But on the technical side, I maintain in the United States of America, there's probably only 5 people walking around who actually understands the process of distillation. You can have a BA in chemistry and run a still in a lab, but to scale it up and to make whiskey on a professional level is one thing, but to scale it up and do it as an artisan on a 100-gallon pot still instead of a continuous column still, that's a different matter, and those are different people you contact for those skills. To put that together. And even like making brandy, you got to have somebody who's made brandy for 20 or 30 years who totally understands that, like in brandy making, the heads and tails go, when you do the cuts on the runs, the heads and tails go back in and are redistilled thousands of times.
Mm-hmm.
And why do the cognac people do that, or the brandy people do that? That's a good question. And you want that kind of information in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, there's virtually no books out there on whiskey. There's Michael Jackson's one, but that's more or less tasting notes and in praise of the Scottish industry. And now, there's less than 100 distilleries in Scotland, where today we're over 200 strong and growing.
Right here in the United States.
Yeah.
When you mentioned handcrafted, and I often hear the term artisanal distilling, craft distilling. Could you clarify for listeners just when they think of spirits, they think of something in a bottle. But what's the difference here? Does a craft distiller?
Right now, the definition is 60,000 proof gallons to be an artisan distillery. So that's kind of the definition, and I think that will have some exceptions as people get past that. But 60,000 proof gallons is 30,000 cases. That's a lot of product.
Mm-hmm.
The average person out there is probably doing 4,000 cases. So that's one of the dilemmas we're having, is that we talk in cases, but often your taxes are paid in proof gallons. So if I do a survey in the industry and say, how much did you sell last year? Well, if they tell me how many cases, I got a problem, because some people have half gallon, some people have 375s, or 750s, and the public out there doesn't know what a 750 is. They're still thinking quarts. So it's a dilemma on how to record what's being sold. But most people are, just building their marketplace, and I tell people, keep it local for a long time. Don't think you can develop a national brand. And if you did, you couldn't fulfill the pipeline. For example, I was talking to a guy from Nevada. He was telling me that the Bellagio Hotel serves 20,000 cocktails every weekend.
Wow.
Think of all the alcohol people that are knocking. I think there's 23 restaurants in the Bellagio. Think of all the suppliers who want that marketplace. So you as an artisan, you might get in one restaurant one day. But it's going to be a while before we really crack the top-end market of the best restaurants in the country. But the interest is there, and when chefs find out about us, and when these high-end bars like the Brandy Library in New York City, they want to carry the best products out there.
Is it in your experience, is it still the case that those who want to produce an artisanal spirit face daunting challenges in order to get their product picked up by a distributor? Because that is, as far as I know, still the necessary step everywhere before you can go into a bar or a retail establishment.
Well, remember, we have 28 states that are liquor control states. You don't even have a choice on that one. You sell everything in the state, and then the state places it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a dilemma for some people. But other guys I know, like in Philadelphia, they love it because he just goes on his BlackBerry, and every Friday he can see what city sold the most alcohol, and he can focus on that into the marketing. But the control states are a real problem. You can't really self-market yourself very well. You know, you can't take a bottle of your alcohol into a bar and pour for the owner and have him taste and then have him purchase from the state. I think that's against the rules there.
Yeah.
And on the three-tier system, you got to sell to a wholesaler who wants to be successful on your dime. So you almost have to plan a dollar per bottle on marketing in the first couple of years.
So yeah,
I try not to go into the black hole, because it's extremely complicated. And I just finished a list for the whole country. I had a young lady research this for me and cross-reference off of everybody's website. And I have a list of 280 wholesalers who handle craft distillers. But I have a feeling there's 25,000 of them out there, who handle wine, beer, and spirits, and every town it might have five. But how do you find somebody who really appreciates the fact that you have your own 40 acres of sugar cane that you grew, and you're going to make your own handcrafted rum and cassasha? You want people who are really rum people and who are going to order your product, and then you have to have a license to ship it to that state, and you pray that the licensing is not that expensive. But if you're down in Georgia and you want to ship to five states, you got to be licensed in those five states to ship alcohol. So it becomes a huge, complicated system, and there's no guidelines. There's no book you can pick up to tell you how to do that. So what we try to do here is, on my mailing list, I make sure all the major wholesalers and retailers, or the bigger retailers, are on my mailing list, and they get our directory and get flyers from us and let them know who just opened their doors and what they're producing. And because I think the next renaissance, I know the next renaissance is going to be whiskey, and there's going to be a lot of interest in a lot of new rye whiskeys out there already, and there's a lot of them are unaged rye whiskeys, because the rye whiskey is peppery and makes a nice mixed drink. It's fairly easy to ferment it and distill it. And a lot of these guys are not using a traditional mash tun. They're distilling on the grain, which I keep telling them, you want a mash tun, you want to distill from beer. It went through a mash tun, not just pump all that grist into the still and distill on the grain. But there's going to be a lot of ways to skin the cat.
Uh-huh.
A lot of different kinds of stills. A lot of people have different dreams of how they do it. But I tell people to that you have to be promoting the, like I'm arguing with a guy about, I'm just not a corn whiskey guy. And he says to me, Bill, I'm standing in the window of my distillery and I can look out the field and I can see the corn. It's free. Or almost free. It's 8 cents a pound. I have to use corn. So you do with what you've got, and if you're in certain states, if you're on the East Coast, of course you're going to make rum, because there's a history of rum in all the seaports from Miami to Bangor, Maine. All those towns have a huge history of rum, so you definitely would want to be a rum distillery. And going back in history, the bartenders have been traditionally pouring rum and etc. And also right now, for example, there's a little renaissance going on in the brandy industry, but apple brandy is going through a really big surge now. And I know Laird's apple brandy, which is aged 12 years, is sold out.
Wow.
And I was talking to Ted Huber down in Indiana. He says there's a huge rush on his brandy. It won some gold awards. His apple brandy, it won some gold awards. And it's a very flavorful brandy. It can be used in cocktails or just drank straight on ice or soda or whatever. And so we're reinventing, as our industry goes through this renaissance, we're reinventing some old tired brands. And one of them, like right now, brandy is basically owned by, Gallo and a couple other big industries. But there's probably another 60 people out there making brandy on small wineries.
Mm-hmm.
Who have stills. But for them to market it is very hard. Eau de vie are very hard to market. Brandy made from pear or cherries or whatever. So we got to reinvent those so the public and restaurants begin to appreciate those wonderful products.
Yeah, absolutely. In the 12 years I've been running alcoholreviews.com, I've gotten all sorts of questions, and one question that is inevitably recurrent is, I would love to try to, I've home brewed before, but I would love to try to distill at home. But the one thing I fear is that if I do, I might make something that'll cause me to go blind. I don't know.
You can't drink it when it's bad. Because I started as a brewer, I know that the microbrewery industry has a huge advantage to bring new people in, because there's so many home brewers out there. There's tens of thousands of people brewing at home. On distilling, all we have is these moonshiners out there, and I won't even listen to them. They are relying on folklore, and their techniques are, we buy 50 pounds of corn, 50 pounds of sugar, and we ferment it, and then we distill it. And I said, what do you do with the corn when it's left over? And he said, we use it again till the flavor runs out. So they'll distill a sugar water base on the same mash of corn four or five times till, quote, the flavor runs out. I said to them, all you're making is a rot gut rum. And they're not even doing a starch conversion on the corn. And they don't even know what starch conversion is. And they don't know what heads and tail cuts are. They kind of intuitively know the first little shot that comes out of the still, you always throw that away. That's loaded with aldehydes. And the tail tastes pretty nasty when it runs down, so they kind of go for the sweet spot in the middle, but they don't own a hydrometer, and they don't keep a logbook, so I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah.
I mean, they just, it's, so there's only one guy selling moonshine-style stills out of Arkansas, coppermoonshinestills.com, and if you went today to order one of his 30-gallon stills, I believe last time I talked to him, he was 85 orders on the waiting list.
Wow.
So there's a lot of people doing an illegal activity, which federally is against the law to distill at home.
Sort of like
I tell people, if you do it, don't ever brag about it. Use the stuff to power. You can actually get a permit with no inspection to generate alcohol to power your lawnmower. and the process is exactly the same. I wouldn't put it in my car because, again, when you do it at home, you don't really set up on a first run off of a sugar wash. You're lucky to take 8% alcohol from the wash and make 30% spirits. You got to double distill it because these stills are so inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
And again, most of them, there's a couple of books. One of them comes out of Alaska, and I just maintain, and these guys have sold tens of thousands of books. There's a couple of old moonshine books that have sold for 20 or 30 years that just have disinformation. It's bad information. It's not current information. They don't talk about heads and tail cuts. They don't talk about the fermentations. I was at a place where the sugar fermentation was 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I flip out. I mean, you're throwing esters. You're getting all kinds of bad flavor. And the wash is going to go in the still, and that's going to get carried over. You want to do it like a beer, a 70-degree fermentation. Well, they don't have the tank jacketed, so when it heats up, it heats up. I say, well, then you put a copper coil with water running through it to control that fermentation, to keep that temperature down. Well, I never thought of that. So they don't do any research because there's very few books out there, and there's no courses to take. There's no university courses to take. I offer classes on my website, distilling.com, and I offer a hands-on class for people, but the people who come to my class is $3,500. It's 1 week long. We pick you up at the airport. We have a chef on staff. We visit other distilleries. My first person to talk to the group on Monday morning is an attorney.
Ah.
He lays out what are the rules for getting your license, and I limit the class to 12 people. Well, the 12 people who come, very often I get one or two winemakers, I get a sommelier, I get people who are along the learning curve. You just can't say, you would not sign up for my class as a total beginner, because we're going to be talking about aldehydes and esters and the flagellator on the still and all kinds of stuff, and you haven't even looked at a vocabulary in a book to understand what we're talking about, so you're wasting your time and money. You better be doing your research and have a little library of books and have visited one or two distilleries. Or if you haven't ever done a wine or a beer fermentation, you got a lot to learn before you do the distilling, because everything in distilling comes from a previous fermentation.
Right.
So
it's a whole different thing.
Go to Costco and buy a 50-pound bag of sugar and just try to ferment it. I mean, you can throw it away afterwards, but it doesn't cost you but $23 to ferment 50 pounds of sugar. But, you know, to make it like a rum, but, you know, the stills you buy are just, they have a flat bottom, they're primitive. There is one thermometer up in the head of it, and the instructions are pretty primitive. I can't advise you to do that because, again, it's against the law.
Right. Right, it's ironic. It's I remember as a kid growing up in Ohio, the state said, you know, of course it's illegal to send off fireworks on the 4th of July or any other day
right.
of year, but at the same time you could buy fireworks, and then you had to sign a little form saying that I, of course, will not discharge these in the state of Ohio. So
inside your house.
it was kind of silly.
In Ohio, I've been getting a lot of the queries out of Ohio. I think that's where Tom's Foolery is, right? You know that distillery? His wife is making fun of him, so you call it Tom's Foolery.
No, I did not know of it.
Great apple juice brandy. I think there's two other distilleries under construction in Ohio.
Hmm.
It's very interesting. The states have some, not much moonshine history, but there's still some, there's a distillery just opened up in Little Rock, Arkansas. So these people are scattered here and there who have this interest in the distillation. I think more than anything else that's happening in our society is there's been this renaissance in food, baking, wine, beer making, and now we're the last of the artisans to come along and have this renaissance in spirits. I mean, we have guys now making absinthe for the first time.
Yeah.
So that they got rid of that mythology. There's just a lot of mythology involved from, quote, the bootlegging and that kind of part of the folklore. And, you know, the mythology is mythology. You know, moonshiners didn't dare keep a logbook because you could get this proof to arrest you.
Oh, exactly.
But when you read, Minnesota 13 about moonshine in Minnesota, the way you could find a moonshiner during the Great Depression is you drive through town and see who had a new car. because these are the only people who could feed their family and make money was by moonshining. So it has that kind of richness to the history that you had to do something illegal to feed your family.
Mm-hmm. All right. Here is my final question for you, and it may not be I thought it would be an easy question, but it might not be, considering how busy you are. What's next?
Oh, boy. Well, wine and beer have been through the Renaissance. Spirits is the next to go through the Renaissance. What I think is going to be next is for us is the restaurant distillery. Where you can walk in. Well, actually, there's three or four people who have winery, brewery, distilling licenses all together. So the farm distillery is going to make a major renaissance. I think that's, once we can get the laws changed, and we're doing this state by state, to allow the customer to drive up to your farm, and you can sell them a bottle of corn whiskey, or a bottle of rum, or a bottle of vodka, or whatever. You can sell them a case to carry home. You can make some money. Mm-hmm. And the guys who are really, 10 years ago had an apple farm, couldn't pay their bills. Now on the weekend they're selling apple pies, pumpkins, and apple brandy, and doing $10,000 weekends for the August, September, October, where families go out to the countryside to participate in this revolution in food and drink. And
yeah.
And be part of that, pushing that edge, that dad can take home a fine bottle of apple brandy to enjoy at Christmas time and like that. So I think working on the laws to get us the same tax breaks as the wineries and breweries have, and to get the information out there on how do you start up a distillery? Where do you begin to get that information out there, to have transparency, and how do you pay your taxes, and how do you do things legally, how do you get licensed so that, I know, let's see, where was I was in Virginia. The guy's been open just a year, and he's now on a farm tour. Where you on this time of year that people do these tours of different farms?
Yeah.
The distillery's on the farm tour. In 2 days, he saw 600 visitors.
Wow.
There's a terrific curiosity. People love to visit breweries and wineries. Think of the wine tours that go on with 7,000 wineries in America. People every weekend are going to wineries. Well, distilleries will become part of the culture on that level of activities for families and people to do.
Excellent. Well, Bill Owens, thank you so much for talking with us today, and we'll keep an eye on you, and we'll keep an eye on distilling.com.
Yes, and you should also take a look at this month's Smithsonian Magazine. There's a feature on me on about my book, Suburbia. I'm a photojournalist, and after 42 years, my book made the Smithsonian Magazine, and so that's kind of fun to have a little applause from another art that I've been.
Congratulations. Well, we're here down in D.C., and Smithsonian is not far away, so we'll take a look.
Oh, it's on the newsstand now.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.